From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. No doubt, Martha Hughes Cannon was a trailblazer. Independent and driven, she went to medical school, she pushed for voting rights for women, and she championed child welfare and public health issues as Utah's first woman state senator. But Maddie, as she was called, was also very much a product of her time and her faith. She married a much older man, becoming his fourth wife. By the 1890s, polygamy was against the law and against LDS church doctrine, and Maddie twice went into exile to protect her husband from prosecution. A new documentary traces Cannon's complicated life, and today on the program, we're talking about the remarkable Martha Hughes Cannon. Plus, cowboy poetry, folk arts, and music with Hal Cannon. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. With pretty much any aspect of Martha Hughes Cannon's life, you could say it's complicated. In the late 1800s, she was a physician, a suffragette, and Utah's first woman senator, but she was also a sister wife and had a very romantic view of the world. A new KUED documentary tells a story of her multifaceted life, and today on the program, we're talking about Maddie, as she was known, and her remarkable story. Joining me in studio is Nancy Green, a producer at KUED Channel 7. She specializes in the production of long-format documentaries for local and national PBS broadcasts. Her work has won numerous awards, including a Rocky Mountain Emmy, a Gracie Award, and honors from the New York Film Festival, Iris, and Houston World Fest, among others. Her latest documentary, Martha Hughes Cannon, airs this Sunday, July 22nd at 8 p.m. and again next Tuesday, July 24th at 9 on KUED Channel 7. And Nancy Green, it's great to have you in studio. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Later on the program, another Cannon who I don't think is related, but is remarkable in his own way, Hal Cannon, will join us to talk about his music and his muses. But first, Martha Hughes Cannon. What do you want to know about this notable woman in Utah history, and what do you make of the many contrasts in her life? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Nancy Green, you've produced documentaries about the labor activist Joe Hill, about Utah's journey to statehood. What really hooked you about Martha Hughes Cannon? What got you interested in telling this story?
Well, for those documentaries, really, I worked with Ken Verdoya, who's an amazing producer, and we produced just these incredible tales of the West. But they were all male-based. I mean, they were all incredible men. And I really wanted to do a story about a woman, a woman who was influential, a woman who maybe wasn't so well-known.
Martha Hughes, tell us about her early life. Born in Wales in 1857, and was part of the Mormon pioneer immigration to Utah.
Her parents were early converts, and they made the trek across, ended up in New York from Wales. And her father was terribly ill at the time. And they desperately wanted to make the trek to Utah to gather with the saints at the time, this notion of the gathering in Zion. And so they managed to do that. They managed to go up to Nebraska and then make the wagon trek across. But it was a really difficult time, as it was for many pioneers. And Maddie, her mom had recently had a young daughter, and Maddie's younger sister ends up dying along the trek. Maddie's father barely makes it into Utah. He gets to see Utah, is here for just a few days, and then he passes away. So really her beginnings were very similar to, I think, a lot of immigrant experiences where there's a lot of hope, a lot of faith, but also a lot of pain.
Mm. So her mother, a young widow, got two little kids in tow. I mean, how did that experience, that hardship, how did that sort of shape Maddie's character?
Family lore, family tales say that basically that incident really was one of the things that instigated her wanting to go into medicine. And she would have seen, just growing up, she would have seen a lot of disease, a lot of illness, at her mother's side. And I think that really influenced her to say, hey, I want to do something about this. I want to make a difference in the world. That's one thing about Maddie's character, is she always felt that she could do something important while she was, you know, on this planet. Mm.
Talking about Martha Hughes Cannon, the subject of a new documentary that will air on KUED Channel 7 this Sunday night at 8 o'clock, as well as next Tuesday, July 24th at 9. Nancy Green, the producer, is in studio with me. If you've got questions or comments about this enigmatic character in Utah history, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned she just really embraced medicine. She went to medical school. Pretty unusual for a woman at the time.
Very unusual. I mean, this is the Victorian era. This is when you have these separate spheres, they called them, between men and women really were encouraged to take care of the home and hearth and not go into careers. And Maddie embraced medicine. And she goes off. She doesn't just embrace medicine. She tries to do everything the best she can. And so she doesn't just go to, they had one or two female medical schools at the time that were just devoted to women. She doesn't do that. She wants to break out of the mold. And she goes to a man's medical school. And that was really unusual at the time. So she from an early age, I think she was pushing boundaries.
She went to school in the East, but returned to Utah and did some pretty remarkable work here. Didn't she create a nurse's school?
She did. At one point, she came back and created a nurse's school. She opened up a thriving practice. She really wanted to she had a notion of, I think, bringing health and medicine to Utah, especially to Utah women.
Mm-hmm. And what was Utah like at the time? Can you sort of set the stage what personal hygiene, what public hygiene meant?
Yeah, this was not, you know, today we have sewers and sanitation, we have running water. I mean, really, there was a wonderful historian, Sam Brown, who describes the environment at the time. And basically, it's, you know, if you imagine just a bunch of farms strung together, that's what Salt Lake was like, where you have just livestock roaming. You don't have sewers. You don't have sanitation. You know, it was just, in a way, what we would consider today a filthy mess. And so you had things like dysentery. You had, you know, illness that could be spread rather rapidly.
Mm. So far, you've painted this picture of Maddie Hughes as this, you know, driven, independent, ambitious, strong-willed woman. And yet she did want love. She wanted intimacy. She wanted a companion and a relationship. I want to play a clip from your documentary. This is the historian D. Michael Quinn talking about Martha Hughes Cannon's choice to become a polygamist wife.
She and nearly all of the devout young women that she knew in Mormon society had an attitude that they would rather become the wife of a seasoned man who had been, quote, tried and tested in the priesthood than to become the sole wife of a young stripling who might not be able to pass muster, who might falter, who might not be as devoted to the gospel.
I am not simply satisfied, but also proud of my choice. I would rather spend 1 hour in your society than a whole lifetime with any other man I know of.
That is the voice of Martha Hughes Cannon. And to the modern sensibility, it seems a little strange, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, at first glance, I looked at this and I was like, what was she thinking? What are you doing? I mean, she ends up, she has this career, she's accomplished, she comes back, and she ends up marrying a man 23 years older. With three other wives, 17 kids. And today, looking at it from our sensibility, you just have to scratch your head and go, what's this about? But if you start to look at the time, it makes a little bit more sense in that she really, if she's somebody who's always trying to push for the highest goal, in her world during that time, polygamy was considered the highest form of marriage. And so, you know, and she was somebody with a strong spiritual side, so she was trying to find somebody who would match that. But really, she could have had her pick of anyone. She had suitors left and right who were courting her. She had somebody, when she was in school out east, she had somebody follow her back to Utah because he wanted to marry her. And she turns everyone down and chooses Angus Bunn Cannon.
Tell us about Angus Cannon. Maddie becomes his fourth wife, much, much older. What do you think the attraction was there?
I think, and it's hard to know, but I think he was a very spiritual man. And I think that she was very attracted to that side. Also, I haven't seen anything that supports this, but family accounts say that he was also had a good sense of humor too. And so there was something there. It's hard to know. I don't know, you know, can you ever explain what the attraction, romantic attraction between two people could be? But I think she really saw in him somebody who was a leader. He was the head of the Salt Lake Stake, which, you know, the head of a large religious community, and somebody from a very powerful family. And so I think, you know, I think he just spoke to that side of her that wanted that kind of spiritual commitment.
Hmm. This is another clip. This is, I'm not sure, are these the snippets of Martha Hughes Cannon portrayed in the film, or do they come from letters or?
Almost everything comes from letters or newspaper accounts. Martha Hughes Cannon, we call her Maddie. Maddie burned her diaries. She had her son burn her diaries upon her deathbed. So really, we don't have any journals from Maddie. But she wrote a lot of letters, and she really did pour her heart out in a lot of the letters. And fortunately, Angus, a lot of them were to Angus, and fortunately, he kept them, although she kept telling him to burn them too. So much of the voice of Maddie comes from these personal letters, and they're read wonderfully by an actress, Sandra Shotwell.
This is a clip from in Martha Hughes Cannon's voice, really talking about polygamy as a conscious choice.
A plural wife is not half as much a slave as a single wife. If her husband has four wives, she has 3 weeks of freedom every single month. A plural wife has more time to herself and more independence in every way than a single one. Martha Hughes Cannon.
To me, that really gave me insight into why this, you know, strong-willed woman would enter into this sort of a partnership. I mean, it did give her a lot of independence, and it did empower her to live a life of her own.
It really did. I mean, she was somebody who... It was one of the paradoxes of Martha Hughes Cannon, I think, is that on one hand, she really longed for this romantic partnership with one person to be their soulmate, if you were. And on the other hand, she also was somebody who was very independently minded. And polygamy did give women that sense of autonomy. Sometimes it came with a high price. Sometimes the women were almost like single mothers. And I think Maddie had that. But also it did. It allowed her to pursue her career, to pursue her interests, when perhaps a more traditional marriage wouldn't have.
But it certainly wasn't all roses. Society was changing. The culture was changing. The laws were changing. Talk about, you know, put this into a little bit of context for us. At the time she got married, polygamy was accepted. Shortly after, that changed.
So she grew up in a world where polygamy was accepted, in the culture that was accepted, but it really wasn't accepted in larger culture, in the United States culture. You know, early on, polygamy was considered this twin relic, much like slavery, a twin relic of barbarism. And there was a lot of persecution. And actually, Maddie marries at the height of prosecution from the federal government. So she goes into this choice. She makes this choice at a time when she knows that it's not going to be an easy road. She knows that there's going to be a federal crackdown, that literally prosecutors are inside of Utah. They're you know, peering into windows. They're observing people, and they're bringing charges against polygamist leaders left and right.
And yet she clung to the marriage. I mean, she wasn't willing to abandon it. She even left the state twice. She went once to England, once to San Francisco, so that her husband wouldn't be prosecuted. What was that exile like for her?
At first, the exile, when she went to England, at first it was, I think, exciting. Here she is, a very literate woman, a very dramatic woman in the land of Shakespeare. And she first enjoys it, but then it becomes more and more difficult. She's on the run. She can't stay in any one place too long. She is separated from her family. She's separated from her husband. And I think the emotional toll of that she had a high price to pay. She becomes more and more depressed. And I think her, as you read her letters, you could just see her descend into this, almost this sense of despair.
I want to play one clip before a break. This is, again, from the documentary Martha Hughes Cannon.
As time wears on, I find I have not the fiber I once possessed. I will never be able to practice medicine day and night, thinking of how I used to jump out of my bed at the ring of the telephone at all hours of the night in all weather quite unnerves me now. My nervous system has received a shock that it will never entirely recover from, I fear.
Women especially were expected to sacrifice whatever personal preferences or desires that they had in the name of their duty, in the name of what was proper, in the name of their marriages and their families. The bedrock of this ideology for women was suffering self-sacrifice.
My own loved one, you could never realize my present situation unless you were suddenly banished 7,000 miles from the scenes of your former activity, your identity lost, afraid to audibly whisper your own name. How I long to see you. I'm beginning to realize more than ever how dear you are to me.
You can get a real sense of the loneliness, the isolation, mm-hmm. and the depression, as you say.
Yeah, it just keeps seeping in. And I think again, this is a theme throughout her life, this sense of wanting to do what's right, but also finding that she has such high ideals and such high romanticism in life, and finding that she just can't have that fulfilled.
Mm. We're talking about the doctor, the stateswoman, the advocate Martha Hughes Cannon. The documentary Martha Hughes Cannon will air this Sunday night at 8 o'clock, July 22nd. Again, next Tuesday, July 24th at 9 on KUED Channel 7. In studio with us, Nancy Green. She's the producer of Martha Hughes Cannon, the documentary. And if you'd like to join us, what do you want to know about Martha Hughes Cannon? You can give us a call, 801-355. Talk is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. When Martha Hughes Cannon ran against her husband for a state Senate seat, the Salt Lake Herald endorsed her, opining that she was the better man of the two. As the first woman to serve in the Utah Senate, she pushed for improved sanitation and child welfare protections, but her faith in polygamy eventually led to the end of her political career. She's a very colorful character in Utah history, and today on the program, we're talking about Martha Hughes Cannon, the subject of a new documentary produced by KUED Channel 7. Nancy Green, the producer, is with us. The production will air on Sunday night, July 22nd at 8 o'clock, and again next Tuesday night, July 24th at 9. And you can join our conversation if you've got questions or comments about Martha Hughes Cannon. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. What got her interested in politics? Clearly, you know, a very passionate woman about medicine and about making sure that people get the health and the help that they need. What urged her, pushed her into the political sphere?
I think a couple of things. One is that she always saw herself as somebody who could be a public speaker and fight for better health and public sanitation. But also, she's a woman who grew up with the right to vote. In the Utah Territory, women got the right to vote in the 1870s, and then it was taken away from them during the time of persecution over polygamy. And so she grew up with this sense of equality, and I think she really wanted that back. I mean, it just made sense to her that all men and women should have that right to vote, and so she became a very fervent suffragist. She spoke nationally on the cause. She was a wonderful speaker. She had a great dramatic flair. And so she really became known politically inside of Utah.
Mm-hmm. And this, I guess this civic involvement is what encouraged the Democratic Party to harness her energy and to say, be our candidate for state Senate. Ironically, her her husband was running as a Republican in the same race. Is there any documentation, any indication about how this political contest affected their relationship?
In an interview Maddie gave, she basically said, "Oh, well, it hasn't affected us. It's fine." But if you read letters from later on, once Maddie actually wins, you could tell that there was a bit of consternation, that especially when Maddie would vote in ways that Angus really didn't like. And Maddie was her own woman. She wasn't going to let Angus or anyone dictate how she voted. So I think, you know, the public face, it was, oh, this isn't a problem, but it would have been great to have been a fly on the wall that evening that she won and have seen what went on in the household.
Her strength really came out in some of the measures that she was pushing as a state legislator. Walk us through some of the issues that she tackled and, you know, some of the achievements she was able to garner during her time in the legislature.
Yeah, she really, I think first and foremost, her biggest concern was sanitation and health. And so she really pushed for the creation of a state board of health. And there had been earlier attempts to push this through in the Senate, but she really was the key driving force. And because of her, I mean, our state health department, the building, is called the Martha Hughes Cannon Building. So she really was the spark that got this whole notion of public health moving inside of Utah. And then she also noticed the need for education for children. At the time, it was called the School for Deaf and Dumb. But she noticed, you know, handicapped children or children with disabilities. She really wanted to make sure that they got proper education and help. And then this seems like a small thing, but she walked into a store one day and noticed that women were standing and just standing on their feet all day long. And she thought, this is absurd. And so she wrote this law to actually allow for women to have stools so that they could sit during the day. And we think about that now. We think, oh, that's kind of quaint. But really, she was somebody who, she was that thoughtful. And she really wanted to address the health and happiness, I think, of the people.
In your research, what did her male counterparts think of her in the state Senate? I mean, do you have any sense of, I mean, was she quite successful in shaping public policy?
She really was. I mean, she garnered a lot of respect. She from all different sides of the aisle. And quotes were written about her about you're a little condescending in the sense of, you know, like the gallant little lady, you know, in our Senate. But she really did find a way to not alienate the men, but to bring them on board. And I think that was a critical skill that she had. And in fact, at one point, somebody in the Senate, talk started to happen of saying, why don't we send her to the United States Senate? Why don't we nominate her for that? Now, this is incredible because this is before women even had the vote in the country. I mean, this is 1896. Mm. Women didn't get nationally the vote till 1920. I think she really was a good political person.
Mm. Speaking with Nancy Green, the producer of a new documentary, Martha Hughes Cannon, which will air on Sunday night at 8 o'clock, as well as next Tuesday at 9 on KUED Channel 7. Nancy Green, the producer, is with us. If you have questions or comments about Martha Hughes Cannon, call us. 801-355-TALK is the number. And let's go to the phones. Miriam's joining us from Salt Lake City. Miriam, hi.
Good morning. This is fascinating. I don't know a lot about Utah history, so to hear about a woman like this in that day and age is just, it's so thrilling. I'm a woman, LDS Democrat, and while I don't know if I'd want to run for state senate, what an example. And I kind of wonder why over the course of the years, you know, I'm not originally from Utah, and I'm not originally LDS, but the impression of LDS women is that they're very subservient, they cook and clean and have babies and things like that. And how the evolution of that, how, you know, you could have women like Martha Buchanan and then end up with an illusion that, and I don't think we are, but end up with an illusion that LDS women are really less than.
Miriam, it's an interesting point. And I think, you know, Nancy Green, how well known is Martha Hughes Cannon? Do we talk about her in Utah history? I mean, when you were interviewing people, how well known is her life and legacy?
I don't think it's terribly well known. I mean, I think there's certain key people who do know about her. And I think people have heard of her. I think people have heard maybe of some of her accomplishments. But no, I don't think that she's a very well-known figure. I think there are other Utah women who perhaps take the fore. That's one of the reasons I wanted to tell this story. But it is an interesting question about the change of perception over time. And I think a lot of that has to do with, this is just from what other people have told me, you know, restructuring of church hierarchy, that just more and more of the power. Early on, women had a lot of financial control over what they were doing inside of a church. And so I think it's just an evolution over time.
Miriam, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Talking about the life of Martha Hughes Cannon, the subject of a new documentary produced by KUED Channel 7. We were talking about her political career, her success. I want to play another clip from the documentary. I believe this is the historian Constance Lieber talking about her political aspirations, her ambitions, and sort of an abrupt end to that.
With someone like Mattie Hughes Cannon, who was a public official, the outrage was even greater because she seemed, in the view of not only non-Mormons, but Mormons who had wanted to make the transition to be good citizens. It seemed to them that she was in a special case of violating what should have been a higher law for her as a public office holder. What does an oath of office mean when they have continued to cohabit against both the laws of the land and the technical laws of their church?
Clearly the wrong clip and the wrong setup by me. That was the historian D. Michael Quinn talking about the downfall of Martha Hughes Cannon as a politician. Give us some context to this comment. Clearly it didn't end well, but what was the start of her public disgrace, Nancy Green?
Here she is, an elected official. It's 1896. It's after the Woodruff Manifesto was stated, where basically this notion that the Mormons would not practice polygamy, and she's sworn to uphold the laws of the land, and polygamy is illegal in the land, and she basically has another child with Angus, clear proof that she's still in a polygamous relationship. And it becomes a national scandal.
Why did she do this? I mean, was it a conscious choice, do you think?
Well, she
knew the consequences.
She was a physician, and she understood where babies came from. I mean, there wasn't any doubt there. But this is the paradox of Martha Hughes Cannon. And we can sit there, and, you know, from our seat today and go, what were you thinking? But it's difficult to know. You know, part of it, she was still in love with this man, and they still had a relationship. She never, I mean, she loved her daughter Gwendolyn deeply. She never regretted that. But, you know, looking at us from today's point of view, you know, you're this amazing woman on this great trajectory. How could you choose having a child over your political career? But back then, it's hard to say it was a wrong or right choice.
Again, it's complicated. Talking about Martha Hughes Cannon, the subject of a new documentary that will air on KUED Channel 7 on Sunday night at 8 o'clock, as well as next Tuesday at 9. Nancy Green, the producer, is with us. And if you have questions or comments, 801-355-TALK is our number. Tell us a little bit about the research end of this project. You know, since you mentioned that she ordered her personal journals to be burned after her death, how difficult was it to kind of gather bits and pieces of her life?
Really, it had to rely a lot on her letters. And fortunately, Angus Cannon saved everything. There was one letter he actually did burn because apparently it was so scathing. But she would let him have it. But he saved them, and so it was wonderful. We could go to the LDS Church archives and call through all these letters, and it was so much fun just reading all of these letters and finding these nuggets of these little jewels that were out there. And then newspapers, we went out to a lot of original newspaper accounts, and a few people had already there was one biography written of her, so we pulled heavily from that, and then just talking to the family, trying to find out what their stories were.
When you interviewed family members, I mean, were they surprised that she wanted to burn her diaries? I mean, were there theories on why she went that route?
Well, judging from how candid she was in her letters, there's just this conjecture that maybe she just really poured her heart out in these diaries, and sometimes it might have been a little uncomfortable, perhaps a little ugly in the terms of, you know, she really had a lot of anger at times because of her situation. And, you know, here's this woman who grew up in Victorian times, and you're not supposed to let all of that passion and that, the frustrations of life, you're not supposed to let that out. And so I think Martha is that interesting combination of, on her surface, she's a very controlled, very, you know, sort of stoic personality, yet underneath is all this seething passion. And so I think she just wanted to help preserve her image.
This anonymous email, is there a message for modern Mormon women in the documentary? Any connections to the life experience that we see today, both within and without the faith, for women?
I think exactly. I think it's not just Mormon women. I think it's all women. I think there are a lot of lessons inside of Maddie's story. I think one is just not letting life's difficulties overpower you, to, you know, the sense of perseverance. But I think Maddie was somebody who she was struggling with what we're struggling with today. You know, how do you balance family and career? How do you balance passion and reality? One of the historians says, romance dies a hard death for most American women, right? you know, these romantic ideals we grew up with. But looking at that, but I think she's really this example of a woman who said, I'm going to make a difference in this world. And she didn't let life stop her. She really did come through. And if you look at today, 17% of the national legislature are women. If you look at women in politics today, I think if Maddie would see what was happening, I think she would be appalled. I think she really would have hoped that more women would have stepped to the fore inside of the political arena.
Do you think she was a fulfilled woman?
I don't think she was ever completely fulfilled. I think her expectations of herself were so high that she never could be fulfilled. And maybe that's another lesson for all of us, is those high expectations, and to maybe give ourselves a little break. I think Maddie really wanted to go on the national stage and lecture. She never could do that. And I think she was, I think those things were hard on her. I think when life, you know, threw her curves, she always dealt with it. But I think that ultimately she was somebody maybe who was never completely fulfilled. She never attained the pinnacle that she always saw for herself.
What are you hoping that viewers will take away from this, from viewing your documentary?
I think the first thing is just to understand that in our history in Utah, women are amazing. I mean, the women of Utah were radical in the sense that they really fought for equal rights, for equal suffrage. They felt that their voices were important, and I still think that that's important to take with us today. But then this other thing of maybe looking at our own lives, where we have these goals that are so lofty, and how do we deal with the curves that life does throw at us? I think Maddie's an example of a generous spirit, and maybe we need to have that with ourselves.
Nancy Green, she's a producer at KUED Channel 7. Her latest documentary, Martha Hughes Cannon, will air this Sunday, July 22nd at 8 p.m., and again next Tuesday night at 9, July 24th on KUED Channel 7. Nancy Green, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Coming up next, one of Utah's most endearing characters, the musician, storyteller, and folklorist Hal Cannon. But first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. At age 12, Hal Cannon had his first encounter with bluegrass music, and he never turned back. He took lessons with folk greats Rosalie and Jim Sorrells and Utah Phillips. He played with the Deseret String Band for nearly 30 years. He toured the world, and he's still strumming. Today on the program, Hal Cannon joins me to talk about his love of music and his passion for the American West. It's hard to get a hold of you, Hal. I'm so glad you're in town. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Good to be here, Jennifer.
Hal Cannon is a well-loved musician, a writer, a documentarian. He's part of the Deseret. He was part of the Deseret String Band, also known as the Bunkhouse Orchestra. He currently plays with Philip Bimstein's Red Rock Rondo, as well as the Second Hand Band. And along with Taki Telenitis, he produced hundreds of public radio features, which you've likely heard on NPR's Weekend Edition, as well as Marketplace and The Savvy Traveler. He recently retired as director of the Western Folklife Center, which he founded, along with its famous child, the Cowboy Poetry Gathering, the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering. And I put retired in quotes because he's on the road quite a bit now, playing songs and teaching. And he's got a self-titled CD we'll be playing from. But if you've got questions or comments for Hal about his music or his passions, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Hal, let's take you way back. I mentioned you heard your first bluegrass tune at a cousin's house. What was the piece?
Well, I can't remember exactly the piece, but it was a record called Mountain Music Bluegrass Style. It was a folkways record, and I had never heard anything like it. It just was so different than the popular music of the day, and I related to the heart that came out of it rather than the money signs.
What's the appeal? What's the enduring appeal of bluegrass for you?
Well, I'm not actually a big bluegrass aficionado. I played it through junior high and high school, but I haven't followed it too much. But I just like the simplicity of the basic melodies of the work. I don't know. I like the stories and songs. It's a very old way of looking at music. And I know there's lots of virtuoso bluegrass musicians who, you know, put in millions of notes and stuff, but I like the basic drive of bluegrass and old time music.
So how would you categorize your music today?
Well, I don't know. you know, I've been in the cowboy world for a long time, so I've been very much influenced by that, but I'm not a cowboy singer. I guess I'm a Western singer and a songwriter, and I play music in a folk style, although a lot of my friends are jazz and classical musicians, the Philip and the Red Rock Rondo folks, and they play on my record. So, you know, it's a crossbred, I don't know, mutt of a thing.
Well, let's hear a sample. This is a cut from your latest recording, self-titled recording, CD. How about Desert Home? Tell us about Desert Home before we take a listen.
Well, I love the desert. In fact, I live in Virgin, Utah now, but at the time when I wrote this, I lived in the high desert of Nevada in a place called Star Valley, Nevada. And a good friend of mine from the east came out, and I wanted to show him the desert, and took him down to Zion National Park, and he told me that it looked like a big construction site. And I realized that everyone has a little different aesthetic, but I love the aesthetic of the desert, and I wanted to write something about it. And also, in the last verse, I was a little commentary on how prices have really made it impossible for young people to go into the agriculture business just because of speculation. And so I offer a solution to that in Desert Home.
This is Desert Home by Hal Cannon.
Through the rocks and the sands and all deserts demands, through a sky that's eternally blue,
grind through each day, and will work without pay to stay on my dear old desert home. My desert home, burning pinyon, the mountain Douglas fir, the berry juniper. When the rain falls, when the sage calls, come back to your dear old desert home.
Stay on the dear old desert home. Yep. That's your goal, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the more traditional sounding pieces on the album, and it's done more in a sort of bluegrass old time style.
Mm-hmm. In addition to your musical love, you're also well known for your work with the Western Folklife Center. What prompted you to create this space that really celebrated the traditions and the culture of the American West?
Well, I started out my career as the folk arts coordinator for the Utah Arts Council, and I did that for about 10 years. And during that time, I did a bunch of field work. I've always been interested in folklore in the West, although I don't have formal degrees in the subject. But a bunch of us really got together and decided that cowboy poetry was a sort of not well known. It was an insider's art form that was really vital. And there was a reemergence of it, and what it lacked was a forum. And so we did a bunch of field work and gathered all these folks together who write and recite poetry from the ranching tradition, and started the Elko Cowboy Poetry Gathering.
What's the history of cowboy poetry? Is it just ranch hands sitting after a hard day's work and rhapsodizing about the the cows, the steers around them, or what is it?
You know, they're mostly human stories. But the fact is cowboy poetry, even though it's a distinct American tradition, the tradition of pastoral people, of horsemen, supercharging their life with music and poetry is a worldwide phenomenon and goes back to the Greek myths, basically.
Do you have a favorite cowboy poem or a poet?
I love Bruce Cascadon. He was a poet who was born in the late 19th century and ended up as a bellhop in Los Angeles and sort of carrying the bags for the sequin cowboys, and he was the real deal and wrote poems down in the lobby with a stubby pencil. And I just love his story, and he also wrote lovely poems that a lot of people in ranch country love and recite and have in scrapbooks and so forth.
We're speaking with Hal Cannon, the musician, the writer, the documentarian. He has a new, a latest self-titled CD. It's come out within, what, the last year or so?
Yeah, about a year ago. Yeah.
Hal Cannon, singing, strumming still. We're glad to have him in studio. If you've got questions or comments for him about his work, his life, his love of the American West, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You're also quite well known for your work on NPR.
Do a lot of radio producing.
How did that relationship start?
Well, I have a media background in college, I've loved radio for a long time. I lived in the rural Nevada, and radio, NPR was really a big part of our life. We lived in a pretty isolated place, and to be able to listen to the news. And one thing I noticed right off the bat is so few stories had anything to do with rural America, and particularly the rural inner West. And so I saw an opportunity to produce such stories that assignment editors would never think of back in Washington, D.C. So we've been pretty lucky. I think we may have had one story turned down over the last 15 years. But usually, you know, our editors say, oh, we never thought of that one. And they like it. So we produce a lot of stories.
I want to play a clip from one of my favorites. This is, I believe it's from a story called Riding Along on the Cowboy Music Train.
Oh.
Wondered if you could just set it up. What is the Cowboy Music Train?
Well, there's a fella that's back in the New England who has figured out a way to put on these concert tours where you basically start on at one end of a country and end up on the other end of the country and listen to a lot of great music on the way. And so one car is just set up as a concert hall. There's lots of music and people have little sleeping compartments. And I went across Canada with Tom Russell and Rosalie Sorrells. Oh, a couple other people anyway, and interviewed them, listened to their music, and produced a little radio piece with my partner, Taki Telenitas.
And this is Hal Cannon riding along on the Cowboy Music Train.
Naturalist Elsa B. tells us about geology. She even promises bighorn sheep and moose if we keep our eyes peeled. The fact is, the only wildlife I saw was a trio of half-clad hunters mooning the train somewhere in the woods of Manitoba.
Okay, here we go.
Speaking of wildlife, how about 65 people trying to learn to yodel from the master of the bellowing bray, the blustering bark, Sourdough Slim.
All right, give it a try. Here we go. Yodel-ay,
I love that story. And Hal Cannon, I mean, it shows, it gives our listeners a taste of just what a terrific writer you are. Writing hand in hand with music for you?
Yeah, I love actually writing scripts and working with a good editor like Taki Telenitas, who is a fantastic partner.
Speaking with Hal Cannon, and he's got a self-titled CD out. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones. Gary's joining us from Salt Lake City. Gary, hi.
Hi. I have a fond memory of Hal. He may remember this better than I, or maybe not, but when Hal was in high school, His group was the Foggy Mountain Boys. Is that what it was?
No, it was the Stormy Mountain Boys.
Stormy Mountain Boys.
It was one of those mountains and those boys.
Okay. At that time, I was teaching at South High, and I was the sponsor of the Folk Music Club.
Really?
And somehow I found out about Hal's group, and we got him over to South after school for a program we did. And I think I got his group for more than once to play for something I was doing.
You know, we played at South quite a bit. I remember we played at a little program with Ed Abbey one night there, and that was great fun. We had a folk music club at East High, too, that I started with some friends, and it was the biggest club in the school back when we were sophomores.
Mine was really big, too. We had some great kids, great talent, but oh... That's the first time I met you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for calling.
Oh, that was so fun, and I've just kind of followed you ever since. And
Gary, thank you so much for sharing that memory. We appreciate
I've lost my discs of the Deseret string band. Are they? Can you?
Yeah, you
them?
Can buy the CDs on like CD Baby or I think Amazon.
Gotta do that.
Or Intermountain Guitar and Banjo here locally.
Yeah.
Gary, thanks for the call.
You bet.
Speaking with Hal Cannon, that's nice to hear some voices from the past. I want to play another clip from your CD, That's How It Is on the Range. Tell us about this one.
Well, this is another reminiscence of the desert, really. And, you know, when I used to go out in the desert, I'd love the idea that you could be walking along and find the encampment from a prehistoric time. And there was no admission, there was no gates, it wasn't a park, it was just out there. And you'd get in there and maybe even sleep under an overhang, and you'd be where people camped 1,000 years ago and find there were like pottery shards and old little corn cobs. And so I wanted to write about that experience of being in such a primordial place.
Hal Cannon, That's How It Is on the Range.
The antelope.
sleeps, the hoot owl's asleep, then he wanders through, that's all. Clouds race by, smell of rain, but it's dry. That's how it is on the range. Silence is king, every sound rings, even his own darn whistle. But mostly it's still, and that's all that fills the air as he rides on the range. Jackrabbit darts.
Hal Cannon, our time is short, but the cowboy way of life. Do you see interest in a new generation about this culture, the traditions? You know, who is keeping the torch alive?
Well, there's cowboys out there, and there's a lot of people, of course, interested in cowboys in the Western way. But, you know, the fact is that ranch life has taken a big hit. As agriculture has become a smaller percentage of people. But there's all these young agriculturalists in cities and in the country these days. I think there's hope. I think it's being redefined as we speak.
Hal Cannon, thanks so much for your time.
Great, thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.